because you're jumping back into the gap. I'll let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind basketballimmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. I'm excited to have a basketball conversation with Chris Caputo, associate head coach of the Miami Hurricanes. Chris is entering his eighth season at Miami and his 17th season overall on Jim Larrañaga's staff. And wonderful to have him here to be able to have a basketball coaching conversation. Welcome, coach.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, really a fascinating background, and especially spending so much time with one coach and obviously an incredibly successful coach, and the contributions that you've made to that staff, I'm sure, are seen throughout the program. But maybe getting right into it, tell me a little bit about how challenging or easy it is to prepare yourself to be a head coach when you've been with one coach for such a long time.
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for having me. I'm humbled to be on and excited and enjoy talking basketball. And that's the best part of this business in a lot of ways, is the opportunity to meet people and connect and talk about the sport that we all love so much. So that part of it is exciting. Yeah, no, it's obviously working with Coach Larrañaga has been obviously an incredible experience for me. It's crazy that we've been together as long as we have. He hadn't been able to get rid of me yet, so we try to stay
I'm sure he doesn't want to.
Yeah. No, you know, I think twofold. One, when you work for somebody like I do who involves his staff in so much of the program, so much of what we do, really on a daily basis, he really lets you, even from the time that, you know, I first started, I'm 22, 23 years old, we're a big meeting group. We meet all the time. And in those meetings, we share a lot of information, and coach shares so much information with us, not just about program, but, you know, how he's thinking in terms of being in his seat and what he needs to think about in those situations. And so from that perspective, there's really not any area of the program that I haven't at least been able to touch or gotten some insight into. I do think that there are situations where assistant coaches are, hey, you just recruit, or you just scout, you know, you're just dealing with the administrative part of this. But in our program, coach is very, very inclusive. And because of that, it gives you an unbelievable perspective. And then it allows you to make more and more of an impact as you move on each year. You're making an impact in the program. You're not just associated with the program, but you are making an impact. And that's not just for myself, but the other people involved in the program as well. So I think everybody really gains an incredible amount of experience. The other side of it for me is, because it is only one guy that I've worked for, as successful as he's been and as anybody, particularly if you look at the jobs that he's had, you know, these are not easy jobs per se historically, but I found it to be really important that we do things like this. From my perspective, is really be a student, you know, really study the game, read as much as you can, watch film, clinics, try to stretch my knowledge base about, you know, maybe different ways to do things, you know, be connected with people who share the game as you do, you know, be connected with people in the NBA, be connected with other college and high school coaches that are willing to talk basketball and learn. And I think probably, you know, the second best way, other than doing it and being involved in a different type of program, the second best way would be to try to spend as much time as you can learning by reading and watching film.
Well, then that's great to hear, coach. That's great information, coach. And I think that's always a curiosity of people, you know, to what degree different staffs empower their assistant coaches to develop. And clearly that sounds like you guys are. Can you discuss a little bit the meeting concept? I was exposed to that a little bit this year, just having a little bit of access to the Detroit Pistons, and they have a daily staff meeting for all their staff. And the question that I posed was, again, how much communication was open? And they said that it was complete open communication. Everyone was encouraged to communicate. So can you talk a little bit about your staff meetings and maybe what the agendas are and what type of process you guys go through in those meetings?
Sure. We try to have a daily staff meeting. You know, it doesn't work out every single day because there are different things that you have going on. As you know, at this level, the responsibilities that the head coach has a lot of times in excess of coaching and recruiting is they can be great, speaking engagements and things like that. But the days that we are all together, particularly during the season, we do try to meet every day. And, you know, each day is a little bit different, but the agenda is typically, you know, we talk about our guys' academics, what's going on there. We talk about compliance. Do we have, you know, different compliance issues, meetings, things like that coming up? We'll talk about recruiting, which is such a big, important part of what we do. And different times of the year, recruiting will be maybe a major part of the meeting, depending on where we are in the year. And then other parts, you know, we might just be checking in on that and, you know, giving updates and things like that. But then obviously, you know, our team practice, you know, watching film in those meetings, discussing the different issues that we all know come up in any season with any program. So, you know, I would say they're pretty detailed and there is open amount of communication. They can get a little bit long depending on the subject matter or the things we're trying to get through. And I think when you're running a program at the Division I level, you know, there are a lot of things outside of the basketball. I'm sure if it was a meeting in the NBA, it's very basketball centric. If it's high school, you know, there might be some different things that come up. Well, certainly at this level, it's not just the basketball, although the basketball is a big part of it, but there are a lot of different things that come up that could extend those meetings out longer than we would all love.
Of course. And as coaches, I mean, we understand it. And I don't think everyone always understands that we spend most of our time not coaching basketball.
Right.
Exactly. And that's the part that I think sometimes is misunderstood. And especially at the collegiate level where recruiting is such a big focus. And, you know, I think that's one of the advantages of the NBA level is that they spend more time actually coaching basketball or focused on preparing to coach basketball or prepare their team, whatever it may be. So, no, that's great to hear. And one of the other things you mentioned, which I witnessed firsthand when I was down there last year and got a chance to see some workouts at the university with some of the skills trainers that go through there, is that your access to the NBA players, NBA people, different types of skills trainers and everything, that is pretty significant because so many players train in the Miami area in the summer. So how does that impact your program and how does that impact your learning?
Well, it's been great for us. And obviously, when we first got here, you know, we noticed that that was a difference. I know obviously LA is a place that a lot of guys train, but Miami has become a pretty popular training place for guys, including guys who may be training in other parts of the country, but come down to Miami for, you know, a week or two, sort of a little mini vacation for some of the NBA guys, but also they want to get their work in. And then there's a good number of guys that actually live in Miami in the summers. In fact, I was happy to see, well, we're not happy to see the Celtics lose because coach's son Jay is an assistant in Boston. But I was happy for Jeff Green because Jeff, you know, we know him from his DC days. You know, we were at George Mason, but also he lives right near campus in the summer and he spent a lot of time in our gym throughout the last couple of summers. So coach wanted to make this basketball environment. I thought that was one of the things that we needed to do when we got here, is obviously having such great history in football and baseball at the University of Miami. We needed to build a culture where basketball was important. People thought about basketball when they thought about the University of Miami, and having the gym available to the NBA players to come in and work has been really good. And what's been great about it is our players get to see the work that these guys are putting in. Open gym and things like that, they'll play with them, but sometimes it's just popping their head in the gym and seeing, you know, a Kyrie Irving or a LeBron James or Kevin Durant, or even guys like Marcus Smart, who spent a lot of time here last summer, or just any number. Sean Livingston has been here to do rehab, and we've just made the gym available to those guys. And I think it's shown our players, hey, really, this is how hard you're going to have to work, even if you were to make it, to maintain your level of performance. And one quick story that I think is a great one is when we first got here the first summer, we inherited a pretty good team, and then we added Shane Larkin, which was great for us long term. But that first summer, you're trying to establish a culture of work and get the guys to work the way we wanted them to. And the lockout was going on. So if you remember, the NBA players couldn't work in their own facilities. So Chris Bosh,
Yeah.
So Chris Bosh was in the gym with Miles Simon. Miles was working him out at the time. And every day he was in our weight room and in our gym. And they were able to play pickup a couple of times with Chris. And one day coach popped in and, you know, Chris was coming off losing in the finals that first year to Dallas. And everybody was really down about that. And coach had asked Chris, hey, how was the pickup the other day? He said, hey, can I be honest with you? And he said, yeah, sure. You know, I'm just taking this job. I'd like to know about these players. He says, well, you know, those guys just didn't work hard. They didn't compete. They didn't run the floor hard enough in pickup. And you know, I'd like to talk to them about that if I could. And, you know, of course, you know.
Wow, so, of course, yes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, Chris, you know, gave a pretty heartfelt speech to our players about regret and how he felt about losing in the finals and, you know, how that motivated him to work and, you know, how you don't want to, you know, look back and know that you didn't do everything you could do. And so that was really, I don't want to say a turning point, but just an interesting little benchmark in our time here where Chris verbally sort of tried to help establish a little bit of our culture here in the weight room and in the summer by speaking to our guys. So it was pretty neat.
Well, and it's a no-brainer. And obviously at different levels and different places, it's about welcoming back your alumni or your players that have gone on to success at other levels or, you know, even players within the community that aren't necessarily your players. And I know that that's kind of our example here is that, you know, whether there's players from Detroit or, you know, players within our community that went to play other places. I mean, we welcome everyone in our gym because everyone's there ultimately to develop and improve as a basketball player. That helps all of our players be exposed to those different habits or those different techniques, or in some cases, just get better competition. And that's awesome. And then I saw that firsthand and I got a chance to watch Dan Remy run some workouts down there. And I look forward to it coming back there, hopefully at some point this year. So coach, we met basically texting and having conversations. So, and it's been awesome because, again, some of the things that we got into, I think, you know, we come from very different places in some ways, and yet we're very much the same in a lot of the other ways. And I think the thing that came clear to me immediately in talking to you, and which I am 100% behind, is that it's really hard for coaches to generalize. It's really hard for me to generalize about a situation if I'm not in your situation. Because sure, the way that you approach things at Miami are very different than how I approach things, simply because two things, your level of talent, but also the level of talent you play against. And that's what's come clear to me in terms of our conversations. It's just the challenges of you guys competing in the ACC on a daily basis and how that dictates some of your philosophy and your approach to the game. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, obviously I think I learned that from Coach Larrañaga. I think he's been around so long and I think he's had a lot of different type of jobs from when he was at Davidson with Terry Holland, where, you know, a very high academic school and they had success there, and then eventually going to Division II, being a head coach there. I think he learned a lot about that world, and then moving to Virginia where, okay, now you're like the number one team in the country. You got Ralph Sampson, who's the best player in the country for 4 years, which never happens these days. And then you sort of follow that up with Olden Polynes. And so, but yet they had to compete with Duke and Carolina. So as good as they were competing against people who were just as good and had even a little bit more cachet in recruiting, obviously. So, you know, you think you're pretty good with Ralph Sampson, and but, you know, yet Carolina's got Michael Jordan, so, and James Worthy and Sam Perkins. So in any case,
real world problems, eh?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then him going to Bowling Green, I know, was certainly an interesting experience for him over 11 years. And his last year there, they won the league, and going to George Mason, which is a different type of job. And now here at Miami. So learn exactly what you said. I think it's very, very hard for any of us to put ourselves in the shoes of coaches at other places because we just don't fully understand their issues or their problems. And we all have them. And I would say the same thing for, you know, I've gotten to know a lot of people in the NBA and a lot of friends of mine, and, you know, you just don't exactly know what they're going through. So it's hard to judge. You have your philosophies. We all have our theories. You know, as assistant coaches, they're really just theories. We don't get to always act them out. Head coaches get a little bit more opportunity, obviously, to try their theories out. But, you know, I think as it relates to how you play versus who you have and who the other people have, I think it's really important. And one of the things about when we left George Mason, we left a really successful team our last year. We won a game in the NCAA tournament. We were a top 25 team, and we had Luke Hancock on the team, who wound up being the most outstanding player of the Final Four at Louisville. And we had a really, really good group and had a good player sitting out in Sherrod Wright, who wound up being a top 5 scorer in the school history. But what was interesting is we were not a very heavy pick and roll team during that time at George Mason. Coach was not. I mean, we ran a few pick and rolls, but
was that philosophy or was that more personnel? Or both?
I would say a little bit of both. I'd say the world was a little bit different 7-8 years ago, too, in terms of the way pick and roll was being run. You know,
of course,
probably fewer teams doing it. We did have some, but it was not what we did, I would say. I think we had some different things that we did. But we got to Miami, and I think very, very quickly, two things became very apparent. I remember thinking this very early on in my first year. Carolina had Kendall Marshall at the point, and Dexter Strickland at the two was a really good defender. But then they had Harrison Barnes at the three, John Henson at the four, Tyler Zeller at the five, PJ Harrison, Reggie Bullock, and James Michael McAdoo coming off the bench. And that team, had Kendall not gotten hurt, they probably would have played Kentucky for the national championship. That was Anthony Davis.
Right, that was a very good team, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember being, like, watching them fly up and down on us. And we had a pretty good team, too. We were a 20-win team. But I remember saying, like, okay, like, we're not going to out-finesse these guys. Like, these guys, if we're going to try to, like, run around like these guys do, like, we've got no chance because we'll never get the type of players that they could get. You know?
Right, you might get one or two of them, but you won't get all five or six.
Yeah, and when I say finesse, they were physically tough, and they rebounded, and they dominated you near the rim. But more about the pace and the way that they were able to run the floor and play fast and,
of course,
and then dominate you near the rim. They were tough. But I think what became apparent to us, partially personnel, because you get Shane Larkin, and all of a sudden you got a great pick-and-roll point guard, although I think Shane would even tell you that he needed to learn some of that when he got here. And we were able to help them a little bit there. But also, we were not going to get the very best big guys that would be in our league. So the elite front court player that comes into the ACC that's a freshman is probably not coming to Miami. He's probably going to Duke or Carolina or even some of the other powers in the league. The league has changed since then with adding Syracuse and Pitt and Notre Dame and Louisville. But we felt like we needed to get their elite big players away from the basket. And the best way to do that was obviously to put them in a lot of pick and rolls. And so that's why, you know, maybe that's one of the reasons why we've had some success against Carolina and Duke, as good as they've been, and because they've had great big guys, but they're 19 years old, 18 years old. And some of those guys, you know, they're just going to struggle to defend some actions away from the basket. So that's kind of how we've become a heavy pick and roll operation. Now, I think, you know, we have this stat where we say, hey, we're top five in the country over the last 5 years in offense arrived at a pick and roll, but I don't think it's less by design than it is by circumstance sometimes.
Well, and that's tremendous to share and for coaches to understand that, like, basically, and again, I follow this philosophy too, that the best team in our league, they're better at what they do than we could ever be at what they do. So we need to be something different or something that can counter what they do. And in that example where you're saying, okay, well, we're not getting the best big men in the league, we're going to pull their big men away from the basket and put them in uncomfortable situations, is, again, adapting to circumstance. And that's great. And that's kind of what you were getting at when we were talking a little bit. And, you know, I think the next thing we kind of got into a little bit was talking about switching. And certainly that's the trend, is moving towards switching. And I've always been a little bit switch oriented in terms of our personnel and in terms of our league as well, where there's less big on little matchups and offensive rebounding advantages at the rim. But, you know, we got into that and you kind of alluded to the fact that you probably would not shift in that philosophy in a complete way.
Yeah, I don't know that we wouldn't do that. I would say it's really interesting because I do think there's a little bit of, we talk about, you know, no long distance switching, you know, where guys are, you know, like, hey, I'm going to point over there, you point over here and we'll find the man, versus, you know, you want to contact switch and come together. And I think that there's some truth to all of this, right? There's some truth that I believe if you start out switching, I wonder, like, what messages you're sending to your players if you start that way.
About individual responsibility, yes.
Correct, yes. But I do think if you can build that individual responsibility and you get into, hey, we're a good defensive team, we got guys who will give great effort, now we're going to get more into game plan, scheming, defensive strategy, and switching is a really good one for us for these reasons, then I wouldn't be opposed to it. I wonder, like, I see guys in the NBA, they're doing all the switching. I think they mess up their switches a good bit, from what I can tell.
Quite a bit.
But, and what I find interesting is it's also, like, really just the idea of getting two on the ball and getting the ball moving out of that situation. And kind of like, I was at those games when San Antonio beat Miami in 14, I guess it was. And it was, you know, like the beautiful game. Like, I mean, the ball was just popping around, like,
right,
incredible. I was at the games. I mean, they were just incredible. And yet now, like, to try to combat that, I think everyone's switching. And it looks like we're going towards everyone better learn how to play one-on-one.
It's amazing how quickly it changed, even within a season. How different the game looked in the playoffs versus the regular season, in part because of that. And Getting into switching a little bit, and one of the reasons that I kind of encourage switching to a lot of high school and youth coaches, it is because it allows you to focus on player development more on the offensive end.
Yes.
It takes less teaching to teach a defense when you're switching. Yes. And I say that not to minimize the importance of defense, but to get coaches to focus on, at the youth levels, the development of offense. Because skill on offense, no matter what we say about the importance of defense, is still the thing that attracts us most to a player.
Yeah, sure.
Is that true at your level?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I think there are a lot of factors at our level that go into it. You know, size for position is important. Athleticism is important. But skill, ultimately, you know, is super important. You know, and I think, are you skillful enough at your position? And now the days of saying, hey, we want our four men to shoot, I mean, that's like a foregone conclusion. You know, now people are saying, you know, you want your five man to shoot. Those things are super important. Ball skills are super important to us. Maybe the one thing that people talk about, size being a little bit overrated, I would agree with that. And we went to the Final Four at George Mason with, you know, guys that were 6'5", 6'6", post players. But I do think what I've learned is you do have to have a certain level of size and athleticism in our league, we feel like, to be able to defend properly. You know,
of course, yeah.
You know, like, I see all this stuff we've talked about with people about the guys that transfer up, you know, and there's so much transferring going on now. And there's no shortage of the 6'1.5", like, scoring two guard at the low level, a guy who's really skillful, can really put the ball in the basket, thinking that he can come up to this level. And offensively, he probably can. The question is, if he doesn't play the point on offense, like, okay, is he guarding the 6'6" NBA wing player that's going to be in the league at 6'1.5"? Well, how's that matchup going to work for us?
Not very well.
Yeah, like, you know, Jason Tatum's playing the three. Like, is he going to guard him? So I think that's an interesting thing as it relates to, you know, evaluating. But ultimately, skill is the way the game is going, and it's super important. And, you know, we always feel like if a guy is athletic and he's got good size for his position – and he's skillful, we can try to get him engaged defensively. And I think we've done that throughout the last few years with different guys.
Well, and the other thing that I think relates to what you're talking about, and you're the defensive coordinator for the program, essentially.
Yeah.
So this question, and we've talked about decision-making and the importance of decision-making, and anyone that's read anything that I've posted basically understands that I value so much that process of teaching decision-making. But I think what's underrated is how important freedom of decision-making is on defense, because as you already alluded to, when even at the NBA level, when they switch, it's not always perfect and players have to figure it out. What are some things that you guys do within your program defensively to develop that decision-making process on defense?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that there's one specific drill or anything. What I would say, and I would echo everything you said, I think the decision-making is the most important part of it. The better, I do believe that you do have to build certain habits defensively. There are certain things that, whether it be your closeouts or the way you guard the ball or the way you fight through a screen or way you fight through a pick and roll situation. But then once that has been developed, then I think so much of it is understanding the decision-making. We talk about helping. I think a lot of the biggest problems that can happen defensively are guys who overhelp, particularly with the way that the three-point shot come to dominate the game on all levels. The other thing is a lot of things can be cleaned up, I believe, defensively with positioning. In a lot of ways, that's a decision that you have to make. You know, okay, where am I relative to the ball? You know, am I high enough in my gap? If I'm a shrink-the-floor type team, you know, a lot of times guys are so far off the line of the ball that their positioning's bad. That's sort of a decision that they have to make. And then that creates all sorts of difficult decisions for them. So those things, I think some of it is just once the habits are built, the opportunity to play 5-on-5, maybe some breakdown drills, but just the opportunity a lot of times to just stop the play on film and talk to guys about, hey, you know, what are you seeing here? Where do you need to be? Are you pulling in as the ball's going away from you? Are you inching out as the ball's coming towards you? Could you be a little bit higher here? Could you be a little bit lower here? What have you? I heard Brad Stevens say this a long time ago, and I think it's really true, is that discretion defensively and decision-making defensively does need to be earned, though. So I think as a group defensively, if you're doing one thing, I'm doing something else, and the third guy's doing something else, and the fourth guy and fifth guy, everyone's on their own page and saying, well, I'm just making these decisions. I'm just, you know, using that discretion, that freedom to, well, we're not together then. We've got to be together to some level. And then within that, guys are going to have decisions to make and be put in situations where they have to make the right choice.
Well, there's some great stuff there. So let's unpack a few of them. I mean, relating to what you talked about, which the connection I make with you saying defensive positioning, and I don't think coaches always make this connection, is that we spend so much time talking about spacing on offense. What you're really talking about is spacing on defense and being in the right spacing spots. And those things are hugely important on the defensive side and really half the battle. Because if you're early in position, you take away a lot of primary actions. And I think that's really, really
important. Well, I think guarding the ball is number one, but then that defensive positioning is, and being there is really important. And then being ready to move out of there and being physical and all that will come after that. But yeah, I agree. I think defensive positioning is maybe something that doesn't get talked about as much, but super important.
And, you know, relating to the Brad Stevens quote you just talked about, it raises that concept of communication. We have a rule within our team that the first person that talks is right. And even if they're wrong, the first person that talks is right, because everyone else has to then, as you said, align with that person or everyone's wrong.
Yes, and agreed.
Do you guys have some type of communication or some type of process for that?
Well, I don't know that there's a great process other than we scream and yell at guys to talk constantly.
That is
We're not demeaning, but we are demanding of it. But that's a difficult thing, I think, for this generation too. The old joke that coaches say all the time that, hey, if I walked into, in our case, the ballroom before the game when we're having a meal or, you know, night before, and there's nothing better than guys sitting around eating and talking and engaging and the great camaraderie that we all have experienced as members of a team, and guys are talking their butts off. The problem is a lot of times once we get on the court, we don't talk as much. You know, it's like we would talk more in the ballroom than we would once we get on the court. So trying to get those guys to do that is so important. And, you know, that's a process because everybody's a little bit different. And one of the things we constantly talk to guys about is, you know, we have some guys that are maybe a little bit more quiet off the court, and we remind them that there's nothing wrong with being quiet off the court, but there is something wrong with being quiet on the court. And you can't say, hey, that's my nature, that's how I am. It doesn't work like that. Once you step between the lines, you've got to be vocal. And it's something that we just, you know, you try to harp on every single day. And hopefully you're building a form of communication, being very specific. I think that's really, really important. We've had program come in. I'm sure some of the people who are listening may have done this. Some of the college program is a sort of a leadership skills team building exercise. These guys come in, the former military guys, and they take some of the lessons from the military. You know, I think you've seen maybe some of the stuff online, people doing training. Some of it's physical, but there's some mental parts of it too. And they have a great quote that they said, you know, we use precise words precisely. And I thought that was really good because your method of communication and the words that you use are so important.
And the part, like, I'm a big transfer your performance coach. Like, if it's, why am I doing it if it doesn't help us in the competition? And the part that you just said is probably what I've, in my experience as a head coach, at least for 17 years, is the hardest thing to transfer to competition is communication.
Yeah.
It really is one of those situations where you can emphasize it, you can get it going in practice where it sounds like they're coach, it sounds like they're communicating, and then the transfer to the game environment is somehow lost. And I'll encourage coaches, I mean, tweet me at B-Ball Immersion as you listen to this or after you listen to this, and give me some ideas about how you'd help that transfer of communication to game performance, because I think that's one of those things, I think all coaches have those questions, and beyond emphasis, what are the things that we're doing?
Yeah, I think it's funny. Jeff Van Gundy, one time he had been going to some college practices and he told me that. I thought this was really funny. Like, he said, you know, the energy was great. And he said, the one thing that's interesting at college practices where there's a lot of help at our level in particular, a lot of people, managers and GAs and coaches and everybody. Right. And it's like, he said, there's a ton of like coach talk. Like, the coaches are talking, the managers are clapping, everybody's talking on the side. Not enough player talk. So one of the things that I try to remind myself, we are trying to bring energy to a practice setting as coaches, but sometimes we can overdo it and the players are like not saying a word, but everybody in the sidelines going crazy. And then we've said, oh man, we brought energy today. Like, well, did the players bring the energy or did we bring the energy? And like, which one's better? Like, it would be much better if we were all silent on the sidelines and the players were talking through all the stuff themselves.
I can't remember who this is from, but it's a quiet drill concept where,
You know, it's, I think Frank Martin, I had heard.
Okay. And it's an intentional process that, and it's hard for a coach. And I've been finding it in that process of trying to develop leaders and followers within a team, trying to develop players' ability to self-organize, which I think is something at a really young age, not just in basketball, I think at all levels of coaching and teaching that we take away from young people is the ability to self-organize. We organize everything for them so they don't ever rely on themselves. And that process, when I go through it at, say, a summer camp and I introduce a drill, I actually intentionally shut up and instruct the coaches to not reteach the drill, which so often happens, and not in any way teach them rotations. Right. And that's something that I've found is like one of those methods of trying to get them to lead and follow each other and communicate. And it's amazing how challenging that is for you as the coach. Because you can solve it. And coaches, we have the solution. We know the solution. But we have to empower our players to find those solutions on their own through communication. And that's great stuff.
And we might have a great solution on paper, but the guys that are on the floor, that solution will always be better if they're the ones coming up with it, because they'll make it work.
It's got to be them ultimately. It really does. And that's a foundation of certainly everything I believe, is that my answers aren't on the floor. My answers are off the floor. And, you know, and that's the other part that I find that coaches too often, and maybe you can give us a feel for kind of how practices work at Miami, but I think coaches too often give coaching clinics to players, whereas players don't need all that information. That's fine for you and I to geek out on, but you know, the players don't need that information. They need to be in game situations more than they need to listen to his coach.
Yeah. And I think you got to coach in sound bites and have those sound bites. The players know what they mean, and, you know, reminders. Coach Larrañaga obviously doing it as long as he has. I mean, he's masterful at that in terms of getting guys to get a lot of stuff done, keep it moving, can't stay. You know, he's always, and this is what I learned from him about being a head coach, is, you know, it's like we have these great ideas, like you said, for us to geek out on and talk through. And then he'll say, hey, that's great. Like, we're only going to practice an hour and 15 minutes today. So what do you want to do? Like, do you want to not do this? Do you want to not do that? What do you want to take out in order for us to do that? What's important here? You know, are we not going to stretch? You know, he'll always joke and say, well, are we not stretching today? Are we not going to shoot today? Is shooting not important today? Whatever it is. So I think that's obviously being a head coach or being an assistant coach, where you're trying to be helpful in practice planning, keeping in mind that, like, the more we can focus in, work on what's important, prioritize our priorities, that's probably the way to go.
Well, and players learn by physical practice more than they learn by listening. And that's exactly what you're saying. And circling back to where we started a little bit with some of this defensive talk, is you talked about the habits of your team. You talked about closeouts, fighting through screens, covering the ball, et cetera, et cetera. How do you develop those habits? Is that primarily an off-season focus, or is that an in-season focus? Is that a daily focus? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, there is some of it in the off-season, although I think you have to be careful. We're actually getting more time with our players now. There's a rule that just passed that we're going to get more time in the week with them in the summers, which I think is a positive thing. But I also think you got to be careful about, like, doing a defensive drills in July with basketball players, in my opinion. You know, it makes for a very long season for us if guys feel like they're spending their summers fighting through screens and not working on their jump shot or working on their dribbling or what have you.
Coach, we got to stop on that point, because that's so important and can't restate that enough.
Yeah.
If I'm teaching at a summer camp or I'm teaching in the off season with my players, we spend 0% of our time on defensive technique. Now, defensive effort's a different story.
Right.
Like, if you're creating competitive conditions, but you're bang on that players want to skillfully get better in the offseason.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think with that being said, as you move closer to the season, you know, you are really trying to establish a defensive identity for that team. And in our case, we do lose guys. You know, we're going to lose two guys to the NBA this year, and guys that are underclassmen. So you do have some younger guys in the program, it seems like more often than not these days. And our program is not anywhere near what some of the other programs that lose guys in high volume. So, you know, as you get closer to the season, you are, you know, doing some drill work, doing some guarding of the ball, doing some closeouts, you know, learning how to defend pick and rolls in small groups and then into five-on-five situations. And, you know, I think in our – maybe where we might – well, I don't know if we just disagree on this or not, but I think once you're doing some of that drill work to establish some of those habits, then to your points that you make often, that we would move towards more game-like situations where we're playing five-on-five and you guys are reading and reacting, and then we might go back on film and watch it. That winds up happening often in the preseason where you have a team scrimmage, and we've had some pretty good teams and the ball seems to be going in a lot and we're all excited that the ball's going in. And then, you know, when we watch the film, the meeting is takes the tone of, well, look how bad we are defensively. That's why the ball's going in.
I'm glad you said that, because I think every coach goes through that, right? At the end of the day, you're like, oh man, we're playing so well on offense, but oh my gosh, our defense is so bad. But
yeah,
it can be both, though. It can be both. Both can be good, and you can still get scored on. That's the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, so you're starting to build through the film in the preseason, and hopefully as you get, you know, the best way to have a good defensive team, I think, is to be older in college, at least. You know,
the experience of the situations, you're saying.
Yes. And strength physically.
Strength.
You know,
okay.
I mean, guys, at the end of the day, I think that they're 21, 22 years old. They're going to be better defensively than guys that are 18, 19-year-old guys.
We talk about strength in terms of that one contact. That generally you can get away with one contact. And if that one contact has a big impact, then you're going to be better defensively. How do you frame it to your players in terms of translating their work in the weight room to the game?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. We're probably of the school of thought that, you know, we really do lift weights a lot. Like we bench press, we squat. We're not a functional group. We're probably more of towards the Olympic lifts. And part of it is just the mentality. You feel like guys, when they feel physically stronger, when they look physically stronger, mentally, that's a good thing for them as players and as people. But I do think that at the end of the day, we say it all the time in our league, and the other coaches in the league talk about it a lot as well. I mean, the older you are, the better chance you have, because you got experience. And like you said, you've got those situations maybe under your belt. You've gone through something. You've learned. But also, listen, if you bench 300 pounds versus benching 225, you know, physically, you know, the wear and tear on your body, and like you said, the one contact, you're just going to be more prepared for that.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, in terms of the cues that you get having that experience, come far faster to you, that you recognize the situation, you can adapt to the situation faster because you've seen it multiple times. And again, I mean, that for me comes back to not just experience, but also how you practice and putting your players in those realistic situations that you already talked about when you get into your 4-on-4 or your 5-on-5. And they're experiencing things in practice that transfer to the game because they get the same visual cues with an offense versus defense situation.
Yeah, things repeat themselves. I think we all that coach, I think you realize the more you coach or the more film you watch or as the season goes along, you just realize that, you know, those visual cues are going to show up for the players all the time, and things do repeat themselves. Even in a situation in a league, you know, maybe more so in college than at the pro level, where the style of play sometimes is so different. You know, one night you might be playing a team that presses, the next night you're playing a zone team, but things do repeat themselves constantly for players. And so the more we can put them in those situations, the better.
Yeah, that's great. And so some of those habits, is it specific drill work? Is it specific film work? What are some of the things that you find most effective in terms of, you know, we all teach closeouts. So what are some of the things that you have found that help your players the most?
Sure. You know, we've done some stuff with guys, you know, in individual work as we get closer to the season, where we call it like almost like defense 101. And I mean, we're not, I wouldn't say we're super, there's no magic to these things. I mean, they're, you know, just working on guarding the ball, and that might be an opportunity to slow it down for a guy, you know, where you're not in the setting of trying to get through something very quickly. You might, somebody who needs help, that guy might come in for some extra work, and you might work with him on, hey, you know, these are the techniques we're going to work on guarding the ball. Okay, let's do it slow motion where you become comfortable. Now let's speed it up, you know, and then to the point where we're playing one-on-one. I remember one time, Shane Battier, who's on those great Duke teams, told me that some of the best like workouts that they got when on his great Duke teams were after practice. They just played one-on-one. And it's like, you know, hey, guarding the ball and somebody trying to score on a guy who's pretty good guarding the ball. I'm not sure that there's anything better than that if it's two good players.
There's nothing better than that, but those organic moments don't seem to happen as much. Do you find that with your players?
Yeah, and we try to stress to them, you know, we have guys that are really willing to work out, and I think we've got a good thing going there in terms of guys getting in the gym, getting shots, but we do try to remind them, hey, if you're going to stick around a little while after practice, you know, why don't you play one-on-one? You know, why don't you two guys play one-on-one? You know, maybe we put the dribble limits in or what have you. We try to create some one-on-one scenarios in drill work and practice where, you know, a guy might be in a position where he's got to tag a roller, maybe out of pick and roll on a shake action, but then, you know, he closes out and then they play one-on-one with a dribble limit. Just trying to create those scenarios as best we can. But I do think there's nothing better than guys just, if they can play one-on-one, if you can guard one-on-one and you can score on somebody one-on-one, particularly what we're seeing here in these playoffs with all the switching, that's probably a good way to go.
And I don't know how much one-on-one's being played at different practices at the high school, youth levels, AAU levels, whatever it is, but I still find it's the most valuable individual development drill you can do. And shooting drill you can do. And I think sometimes that's lost in its simplicity. Coaches don't do it. And definitely players don't do it on their own. As you said, the part about self-organizing. But I had two recruits in my gym about 2 weeks ago, you know, transfers from junior college level. And the first thing they did when they got in the gym was they started playing one-on-one. And honestly, I couldn't have said, you're welcome to come to our program. You know, and it was just one of those things that's like obviously I had already evaluated them somewhat, but it was just like, that sold me because, you know, they have a certain competitive spirit. And, you know, I think for high school and youth coaches, I think what you're saying is really important.
We find this funny that it's funny you say that. We always joke that on an official visit, when guys come, there's always a segment where they're supposed to watch our team work out.
Okay.
And it's like, you know, for most guys, I don't care how good of a player you are or how into basketball you are. Like if you're 17 or 18 years old, like how interested are you in watching us work out for like an hour and a half, right? Like,
yeah,
or whatever it is. And so, you know, we always joke like we'll know if the guy's going to be a good player if like he sits politely and watches us work for 5 minutes and then walks over to the ball rack and just takes the ball and starts shooting on the side, you know.
That's great.
And then one of our friends in the NBA that was coming in to do some campus visits, because we have these Bruce Brown and Lonnie Walker in the draft, and they come and visit with the coaches and stuff. And he was sort of saying at the NBA level, they were saying, hey, we should do that with our workouts. Like we bring these six guys in to do workouts. He's like, we should just like leave them in the gym with the ball rack and just whoever, like the first guy that picks up the ball, like that's the guy that loves the game the most, you know, or something.
That's great. That's an awesome. Yeah, that's the same translation of that concept of a player self-organizing, but also just having that passion to play. Because again, I don't want my players to have a passion for watching coaching clinics or, you know, watching me coach. I want them to play in the game. So no, that's awesome. That's a great story. So, I mean, there's so many directions I know we can go with this, coach, and maybe a few other things as we go through it, because we've talked about this before, but you've said that you value game-like and you value decision-making, and that coach is big on that. What are some of the ways that emphasis transfers to your players?
Well, I think one of the things, maybe this is not exactly the way to answer the question, but I think it's maybe would be interesting for us to talk about it. One of the things about Coach Larrañaga, if you look at our history, for the most part, particularly in the last, I don't know how many years, there are some exceptions, but he's always been pretty high field goal percentage and pretty low turnover.
Okay.
Like relative to the league or nationally, what have you. And yet, I don't think anybody would consider him to be overly contrived as an offensive coach.
Interesting.
So like you would say, well, people say it all the time. We use it in recruiting. I think it's true. I think the players would say that. You know, they would say, you know, hey, coach gives those guys a lot of freedom, gives the guards a lot of freedom. I think if you watch us play, I think you'd probably say, yeah, it seems like, you know, they are. They're really playing in flow or playing in pick and rolls. And guys are, you know, we're maybe putting the ball on the ground maybe a little bit more than some other teams or what have you. And yet, if you look at the numbers would say, hey, we don't really turn the ball over too much. We usually shoot pretty high percentage, means, you know, we're probably taking pretty good shots. And I think that's sort of – therein lies his genius, in that he can – give those guys that freedom, but they're also being held accountable to taking care of the ball and taking good shots. And, you know, some of that's having good players, but I think some of that is also giving those guys some of these game-like experiences in practice, giving them the opportunity to make mistakes and learn from them. And that's an interesting thing, I think, because a lot of times I think we would consider, hey, if a team is really low turnover, it's because coach is really in control of players.
Couldn't agree more. And part of that relates to this concept of creativity and simplicity being joined together.
Right.
A player that has to do exactly what the coach prescribes doesn't have the ability to be creative and find the simplest solution.
Yeah.
And like, no matter the style of play you play, whether you play slow on offense or fast on offense, it still comes down to that. Are players allowed to make the simplest solution? And that's true decision-making. And I see that when I watch your teams play. I've always enjoyed watching your teams play. And even though, again, the pace that you play at sometimes isn't as fast as, say, my team would play, but I find a lot of stuff when I watch it because you see players get that development. It shows in terms of the players that have developed and moved on to pro level too.
Now, and I think the pace thing is interesting. We've talked about, I know coaches talked a lot about trying to play maybe a little bit faster, but sort of goes back to the question about who you're playing against. I'm not sure that, you know, in our league, it's a great philosophy to come down and shoot very quickly and then give some of the people that we have to play against the ball. I think maybe better to see if they'll defend for longer stretches. Virginia has proved that and done it on such a high level, but I don't think it's any coincidence type of success they've had. That's played a part into it.
Well, that was something that you sold me on right away. And, you know, I'll be honest, I have a struggle watching a lot of NCAA games sometimes, and I tend to watch a little bit more FIBA games. Now, we play FIBA rules, so obviously
that's right. Yeah, and I can understand it.
Yeah, it's just sometimes the pace of play is a little bit of a struggle in multiple possessions of sets. Well, but I have incredible respect for, like, as you said, a program like Virginia that can dictate the game in such a way. And think at any style or any philosophy, we're all trying to do that to a certain extent with what we're doing. So, no, that was it's really interesting to see. And I think that related back to one of our conversations, which was about shot selection, which was about, yeah, again, shooting it quickly. And we played the fastest place we played at ever this year. And we weren't very talented, so part of this was dictated by that. But we turned it over the least amount.
Yeah, what did you do?
Because we shot it early.
Were there some – yeah, right, exactly.
We shot it before we could turn it over.
And everyone talks about the Golden State and the pass number and stuff. And we keep the pass number because we try to get our guys to move it and share it. But it's like, hey, there is correlation between passes. It's turnovers, right? I mean, like a lot – if you overpass it, you're likely to turn the ball over.
Well, and that's the funny criticism of a team like Golden State. Of course, they're going to turn it over more. I mean,
they try to pass a lot. Right, exactly.
Yeah, and Houston's not going to turn it over as much because they're not passing it as much.
What did you guys do to try to play faster? Were there some key things? Well,
emphasis and freedom. That our players had permission is probably the wrong word, but they had the freedom to shoot a shot whenever they're open. And like, it's interesting because one of the first arguments back to that is that, well, we want to make sure our best players have the most shots. And that's 100% true. And we're the same. And I found that throughout the whole year, it always came that way. Like, there wasn't a game where our top two or three players got the most shots. So players know ultimately, and that's the emphasis on those good, great situations where it's, you know, you have a good shot, but there's a great shot. And players define that a little bit, but pace and emphasis.
Did you put any emphasis on getting the ball past half court on makes? Like, did you put a time on the clock and say, hey, we got to get it past
3 seconds.
3 seconds. And who took that out? The foreman or the...
So we've gone, again, this is not, there's not a perfect technique.
No, right.
But what we teach initially is the closest post, so closest 4 or 5,
right.
Or the point guard. So whoever's closer takes it out. And then if point guard takes it out, then the big's the outlet.
And he just throws it right back.
Throws it right back and go. And the other thing that we found that helped us tremendously, and again, it's you recruiting to whatever it is, but it's as quick as possible, we're trying to change sides of the floor. And
you're trying to cross the floor?
Trying to skip, or just pass cross court, not even dribble cross court, but pass cross court. And we're trying to hit ahead, but hit ahead more to the weak side than to the ball side. Although we did get sometimes ball side, we're trying to play as quick as possible to the weak side of the floor because the tendencies of most transition defenses
is to load up.
And we're trying to take advantage of that tendency. And, you know, and again, if we ever get some better dribble drive guys, you know, the counter to that is that teams spread out, and which opens up point guard push or player push and that ability to be able to attack less help loaded in the middle. But those are things that evolve hopefully with better players. But it was fascinating. But so that was kind of our inbound philosophy. But as the year progressed, I certainly didn't coach it as much and didn't care as much who ultimately took the ball out. It was just get it in, like get it in and go. And we even found because of the philosophy on makes, we were a much better primary offense team on makes because we were trying to change sides of the floor as quick as possible. Right. We're running on makes is really difficult. I mean, it really is. I mean,
well, the teams that do it.
Yeah.
It's almost like one of those things where you'd like to Carolina, Michigan State. We've played against those teams. They're elite on makes, you know, that we always talk defensively about when we play them about the 5 second layup. Like we've got to take away the 5 second layup. If often what happens is if you can get those teams in a half court game, you give yourself a much, much better chance. But if you've given up 5 second layups a few times a half, they're backbreaking. They're debilitating in a lot of ways.
Again, I mean, being the defensive coordinator, you've got to think about ways to counter that. And good offense will always win. Do you believe
no
that?
No question. Yeah. Yes.
Good
yes,
offense
yes.
will always win. And that's yes. the hard part about being, I think about being a defensive coordinator at the NBA level. You could do the perfect thing and have the perfect strategy and someone's going to make a shot. And that's the challenge in evaluation. I think that's where, you know, stats and all these things probably helped you and others really define what success has been for defense. And
yeah, we were interesting. We were not as good defensively this year in the second half of the year because we lose Bruce Brown. We get a lot better offensively. We play some younger guys that are really talented on offense. We took a little bit of a hit, you know, losing Bruce, who's a really good defender. But I know this. Like, I do think offense ultimately is good, wins the battle. But I know this also, that you have no chance if you don't defend. Like, you get no chance, particularly against the best players.
Right. And, Coach, I don't know if you know these stats, but I know the NBA level talks about that. If you don't have a top 10 defense, top 10 offense, like both of them in the top 10, it's very rare.
Balance.
Yeah,
I think balance is important.
And most of the champions recently have had closer to a top 5, top 5.
Yes.
So is there an equivalency in your league?
Yes. Okay. For sure. And I think at college, too, we always sort of we haven't had a Final Four team here. We have one at George Mason, coach of two Final Four teams at Virginia, probably before they were keeping a lot of these, you know, advanced stats, although I think they were trying to do it. And I know Dean Smith was like keeping points per possession in the 60s, which shows you where he was in terms of how far ahead of it. But we always try to show our team like, hey, these are the teams that are in the Final Four. Here's where they rank nationally in points per possession in both areas. And again, I think, they're usually, some are in the top 10 or top 5. There are others that maybe the worst number is maybe in the top 30 in the country out of the 350 plus teams. So you got to have balance for sure.
So again, we're getting into this, but without naming a specific team, like can a style of play like Virginia's ultimately win a national championship? Like not saying they're not efficient on offense,
but they have enough
offense to win.
You know, I thought they probably did this year with DeAndre Hunter going out, and I thought they were the best defensive team in the analytics era. And then DeAndre Hunter was such a key for them because they did struggle to score at times, and DeAndre was, you know, he was like that game breaker for them, that when they would put him in at the four and move Wilkins to the five, they didn't really lose anything defensively, and yet they gained a really versatile score at the four in DeAndre Hunter. He makes threes. He gives them a stretch four man. He changes their offense a little bit. Tony's a terrific coach. I think losing him was huge for them. Obviously, what we saw in the first round, I don't think anybody's ever seen. Not only the win, but just the way UMBC was able to score on Virginia.
Completely an outlier, right?
One
in 10.
Yeah, it was all the credit to UMBC, no disrespect to Virginia. I literally couldn't believe what I was seeing when I was watching it. Like, I was like, this is bizarre. I've never seen anybody come off pick and rolls and just score over and over on those guys the way they did. You know, it was just a strange night, and credit to UMBC. But it's also a credit to Virginia because you just never see it because of how good they are. But, yeah, I mean, I think they could. I think they've got the pieces and the coaching and the players to do it. But I also think the tournament is a strange thing. You know, it's about matchups. And it's funny, they were the best defensive team maybe in the analytics era. And I think Villanova was amongst the best offensive team in the analytics era. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing. And Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, I think from a fan's perspective, I think sometimes you don't have that understanding of how random the tournament is, like how random that one-off game is. I mean, no matter your level of talent, it's one game against a team that is equally invested in trying to win and is gone through a season of experiences that can prepare them for those moments. So I guess that's why we love it. But yeah, no, it's a challenge to get it all done, isn't it?
Yeah, no doubt. I think being good on both sides of the ball is key, but it's not easy to do.
It's not easy to do. So, well, Coach, this has been wonderful. I really appreciate you taking some time and
appreciate sharing it. Your game.
And, you know, I look forward to further conversations with you. And I know our listeners will love this. So anywhere they should follow you on social media or?
I'm not a big social media guy. I mean, unless they want to see pictures of my 3.5-year-old. I probably, one of these days, will get to the point where I'm posting a bunch of stuff. I probably should post articles and things like that, but I'm just not there yet. And then, obviously, always great to talk basketball with anybody, but also people we respect, and we respect what you've done and the way you share the game and some of the things that you've been able to put out and the manner in which you put them out, making it easy for people to follow, I think is a skill unto itself. And I appreciate what you're doing and enjoying it.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks, Coach. And no, we look forward to seeing your team progress through this year as well. So I know.
Absolutely. Hopefully we'll see you down here. I know you get down here every once in a while. So
yeah, I'm planning on coming down at the end of the summer. So I'm going to connect with you and get down there for sure.
Perfect.
All right. Take care, Coach.
Thanks, bud.
Thanks. See you, bud. To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations. So connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.